Cyrus, king of Persia, declares that the God of heaven has told him to build a temple to God in Jerusalem. And he declares that he is going to send the Jewish people, anyone who wants to go back, send them back. Supplies and provisions they could possibly need, including many of the temple artifacts that had been taken by the Babylonians a generation earlier. Now listen, most of these Jewish people, chose to stay in Babylon in the only life they had ever known. But a few, just a few, chose to return under the leadership of Zerubbabel. And there were some hiccups. There were some problems. There was discouragement and there was distraction. They needed God to send two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, to remind them of their high calling, their purpose. But in the end, they heeded God's call and they rebuilt the temple. Then we have this 60-year gap between the last verse of Ezra 6 and the first verse of Ezra 1, and the book of Esther falls in that 60-year gap. And many people believe that Ezra wrote the book of Esther as the summation of what he had seen and what he had experienced as a Jew there in Persia. And then he begins speaking in the first person at the beginning of Ezra chapter 7. Esther realized. She took the challenge from her uncle that she had been born for a time like this. She realized that her life was not just about her, that it was God's purpose enacting itself through her life. She realized that her fate did not lie in the hands of the king or Haman and his cohorts, but rather lied in the hands of God. Ezra, he's this scribe, a Jewish scribe living in Persia. And we're told that he studies, obeys, and teaches the law of the Lord. King Artaxerxes gives Ezra the authority to lead a second group of Jewish exiles back to Jerusalem with enough provisions for the journey and sacrifices to sacrifice in the temple when they arrive. And again, most Jewish people choose to remain in Persia, living the only life they had ever known. A few, and just a few, and mainly some of the relatives of those who had gone back with the first return. A few of them go back. They arrive safely, and they sacrifice, and then they begin the task of building a new life in Jerusalem. Unfortunately, word comes to Ezra, some of the men who had returned had married women from the other cultures in the land, and had begun to worship the gods of those cultures and pull away from the one true God. And Ezra is distraught. He is upset. He is heartbroken. They have repeated the same cycle. They're beginning to repeat the same cycle that led to them being in exile to begin with. Tolerate. Tolerate sin. Compromise with sin. Embrace sin, and it embraces you back. Ezra shreds his clothes and he pulls out his hair and he mourns bitterly there in the front of the temple and he confesses sin with abandon. And it's quite a spectacle, actually, and people take notice and they hear his words and they see his demeanor and his disposition and they begin to join in. They join in and start to mourn and confess sin, and this becomes quite the movement. Becomes quite the big deal. But it's only a beginning, the confession. They set up a system of repentance and they rectify. They rectify. They turn around. They go the other way. They rectify the situation. As we come to Nehemiah chapter 1, 12 years have passed since Ezra's return and this spiritual revival. Remember that the capital of Persia is Susa, and the king is still Artaxerxes. We believe that Artaxerxes very possibly could be Esther's son. But he definitely has a disposition, a heart towards the Jewish people and towards Jerusalem. But he's the king. There's one Jew in particular who has grown up in that society, seen all that has happened with Esther, Mordecai, and King Artaxerxes. His name is Nehemiah. Now, Nehemiah has become an official in the king's court. It is fascinating, isn't it, to see what God does with his people no matter where they are. Daniel, Azariah, Hananiah, Mishael, Mordecai, Ezra, Nehemiah here, he's an official. A lot of people just say he's a taste tester. Goes way beyond taste testing. Nehemiah is responsible for the king's safety. And there might be something to this because it was Mordecai who had saved the king. He had brought a conspiracy against the king to save the king from assassination. And the king has him paraded around the city of Susa by Haman, of all people. So there might be some trust. There might be some trust here. Nehemiah is responsible for the king's safety. He's responsible for the king's court, the king's residence, yes, the king's food. You could say that he is the head of the secret service for King Artaxerxes. Nehemiah, who is someone who's been groomed for the king's court and administration, giving the details of the king's daily business and his whereabouts and his travel back and forth. He is such a confidant of the king that the king not only trusts him with his own safety, but he also makes him responsible for an entire province in the empire of Persia. However, while Nehemiah's body and mind are there in Susa, his heart is in Jerusalem. Nehemiah has a brother who has been in Jerusalem. His brother's name is Hananiah. And Hananiah comes back to Persia and tells Nehemiah, hey, things are not going well in Jerusalem. The temple is built and the people are still dedicated and devoted. But the enemies of God, the enemies of the Jewish people have encompassed the city. They've torn down the walls and it's a problem. Our people are vulnerable. They're in great distress. And this news about God's chosen people in God's chosen city, on God's chosen land, doing God's chosen work, disturbs Nehemiah. It breaks his heart. He's so emotionally distressed that it causes a physical effect. He weeps, he mourns, he fasts. And listen, he prays. He prays. Have you ever had something go on in your life that while it is not physical to you, it causes a physical effect upon you? He prays. Nehemiah 1:6 says he prays day and night, and he does this day and night prayer for a long time. What does that tell you? He's going through the motions of his daily work, his daily responsibilities. But he is praying and praying and praying and praying while he's going through those emotions. Now, Nehemiah had never been sad in the presence of the king before. And although he is not physically ill, the king notices that there is something wrong. Has anyone ever asked you, is there something wrong? Are you okay? The king notices something about Nehemiah's disposition. He's going through the motions. He's doing his thing. His mind is praying. His heart is disturbed, but he's going through the motions. He's doing his thing. And the king notices that Nehemiah's disposition is downcast. And what does that cause Nehemiah to feel? Now he's sad and heartbroken, but he's also scared to death. Because you are not allowed to be sad in the presence of the king. Think about that. I think the elders should implement that rule here. You are not allowed to be sad when you come to church. It was a crime punishable by death. It is your great joy to be in the presence of the king. This is the greatest day of your life. This is the greatest job of your life. You should be right there. You should be so happy. You're sad? You don't want to make him sad. Off with your head. I mean, it's that kind of a situation. The king wants an explanation for Nehemiah's countenance. And Nehemiah takes a deep breath and he informs the king of Jerusalem, which is a province in Persia, okay, at Jerusalem's disposition. And Nehemiah requests and receives permission to go to the city with an order to rebuild the walls in the city and set things straight. Letters, king documents, letters from the king for safe conduct through all the provinces of Persia till he gets there. Timber! This is good kingly timber. Timber to rebuild, to make it strong, fortified. And he also receives an army with officers and a cavalry. I mean, this guy is going with pomp and circumstance. He's going to make a splash when he gets to Jerusalem. Nehemiah arrives safely in Jerusalem, and then I don't know how he quite does this, because remember, he arrives with his army, okay? But he secretly and quietly assesses the damage, what's going on here. When he figures it out, when he gets a handle on it, he approaches the officials and the leaders, the priests, the tradesmen, and he tells them what God has put on his heart and what the king has allowed him to do and how God has blessed them with all of this provision. And that they are going to rebuild the walls and the gates and they're going to set things straight. And everybody's like tripping. They're like, "Woo! Yeah, this is great. We're rebuilding the city. We're rebuilding walls. We're going to keep those people out. We're going to be safe again." And they're all enthusiastic. Something that we have to remember is the strategies of their enemy, our enemy, God's enemy. God's enemy has strategies. And he uses those strategies over and over and over and over and over again. He uses them because they work. We fall for it. But he uses them repeatedly, time and time again. One of the strategies is appear friendly. Gain our confidence. And then once he has our confidence, he works from within to destroy. Tolerate sin, compromise sin, embrace sin, and then it'll embrace you back. Another strategy is to discourage, ridicule you and mock you, even threaten you, bully you. Another strategy is to lie about you. False allegations. Or how about this one? Label you. Label you. There was a label thrown out in this country during the last electoral process. I'm that close. I was that close to getting that label tattooed on my arm because I loved the label. Label me. Go ahead. Love the label. One of the other strategies is outlaw things. Make rules against you. You can't do that. Oh, you're not allowed to say that. In fact, if you're saying that, we know your thoughts. We're the thought police. We're going to have to help you figure out how to rethink things. These things, these strategies, some of them were employed against Zerubbabel. Some of them were employed against Ezra in that situation. And now they're employed against Nehemiah. By the way, it's not just against them, it's against us. These are the strategies that our enemy uses today. Come within, destroy from within, ridicule you, mock you, label you, threaten you, bully you. Outlaw your actions. Outlaw your words. Outlaw your thoughts. Tell me you can't see that in the society we live in. The cycle repeats itself over and over again. The enemies of God, the enemies of the Israelites, the enemies of Jerusalem, they were upset that Nehemiah had arrived to rebuild what they had torn down. They're angry. They mock. They ridicule. They taunt. You're too weak. You don't know what you're doing. You're never going to accomplish the work. They literally labeled and falsely accused them. You're rebellious. You're seditious against the king. You're dissidents against the king. You're rebuilding this like a fortress so that you can start an uprising against the king. They threatened to kill him. Oh yeah, you're going against the Persian Empire because we believe the labels we gave you. We're going to kill you. We're going to gather an army around you. And they start to gather an army to go against the city. What's funny is all the while they're saying, oh, come on. Can't we just get along? Let's work it out before this gets out of hand. No one has to die here. This doesn't have to get bad here. Let's find the middle ground. Let's find the common ground. Let's find things we can compromise on. If you don't compromise with us, we're going to take our accusations all the way back to Susa. We're going to tell the king. We're going to tell him what we really think. Meanwhile, they're scheming to destroy Nehemiah's reputation. From within, they start going to other leaders to talk poorly about Nehemiah, hoping that this is going to stir up tumult between them and that they're going to start fighting with each other. Now, if that's not bad enough, in the midst of all this, a social problem arises among the Israelites themselves. The Israelites are investing in their homes, in their fields, in their flocks. But they're taking out loans and using their homes and their fields and their flocks as collateral for the loan. This is not a good idea. To the extent that some of them are even having their children given away to the people from whom they've received the loan as indentured servants until the loan gets paid back. And then, as taxes always do, Persian taxes were going up. And a famine hits the region, that region of the empire. So things are getting really, really tough. Envy and jealousy on one hand, indifference and apathy on another, self-interest all around, and animosity and bitterness grow within the ranks of the economic classes of the Israelites. Those borrowing and those lending. So Nehemiah has this two-front battle going on. He has an internal battle and an external battle. Internally, he steps up and he says, hey, what is going on with you people? We are one people with one purpose and one God. That's who we are. And by the way, brothers and sisters here, God hates, he does, it's in the Bible. God hates those who divide brothers. God hates the dividers. Our enemy's a divider. Even in our day and age, you should be very, very leery of those who divide, those who divide socioeconomically, those who divide educationally, those who divide racially, those who divide. You should always be leery of those who divide. A house divided against itself cannot stand. When you see dividers, you should lean away from them. When you see uniters, you should lean towards them. Nehemiah sees this situation and these dividers, and he says, you know, I understand that this is the way the pagans might treat each other. And I even understand that things get a little bit difficult when we are in agreements with pagans and the Jewish people here, the Israelites. But what I don't understand, my brothers and sisters here in Jerusalem, is why we are treating each other in such a horrible, horrible way. Let's have each other's back in this place. Let's have each other's back within these walls. Let's bless as we've been blessed. Let's show grace and mercy as we've been shown grace and mercy. So Nehemiah begins to confront the internal problem and then encourage them with new behavior. Externally, he steps up as well, and he starts to talk to the enemy. I know who my God is, and I know who I am. And more than that, I know who you are. You are the enemies of God. You're the enemies of my God, therefore you are my enemies. And you have no part of this. We don't want you here. And there is no compromise. You can't fool me. And you can't fool God with all of your accusations. And more than that, I'll bet you 10 to 1 that if you take this message back to Susa and lay it at the feet of Artaxerxes, you're not going to be able to fool him either. So he steps up internally, and he steps up externally. And then again, he turns to his own people, and in the same manner as Zerubbabel, and in the same manner Ezra did, he says, come on, pull this together. We have a high calling here within these walls. Don't be afraid. Stay alert. Keep your eyes open. Keep watch. Keep working. In fact, if we have to, we'll work with a shovel in one hand and a sword in the other. And by the way, if God tells you there are common sense rules to protecting your home or yourself, use them. Don't be the dummy who just says, oh, God will do it. Okay? He addresses the internal problems. He addresses the external problems. He says, buckle down and get to the task at hand. Look what happens in Nehemiah 6, 15 and 16. It reads like this. So the wall was completed on the 25th day of Elul in 52 days. Now that's a pretty fast time to build a wall around a big city. When all our enemies, this is the point. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid. Afraid. And lost their self-confidence because they realized this work had been done with the help of our God. Now, isn't that the point? Remember the theme that's running through this cultural series, the study of the culture behind the text. You're here. You are in this moment. Why? So that the world may know your God. You are where you are. And you are in that home, you're in that family, you're in that classroom, you're in that office, you're in that neighborhood, you're in this church. You're where you are so that through you, God can show himself and the world will know that you are his, he is yours. There's a God in Israel. How about there's a God at Mayfair? In Nehemiah chapters 1 through 6, God shows us exactly how to deal with difficult circumstances that come up in our lives. How many of you have difficult circumstances that come up in your lives? Apparently not most of you. I saw three hands, so the rest of you are just fine. You can all go home now, because I'm going to talk to the three. The three that raised your hands, listen. What we see here in these first six chapters is a man who consistently makes the right decisions. And he makes the right decisions consistently because he knows in whose hand the fate of Israel lies. Who is sovereign over the nation of Israel? God. And only God. He makes consistently the right decisions because he knows in whose hand the fate of Jerusalem lies. Who is sovereign over that city and those walls and that temple? God. And only God. He consistently makes the right decisions because he knows in whose hand his own life lies. God is sovereign over his life. Just like Esther. Just like Esther. If I live, I live. If I die, I die. He's sovereign. I have a purpose here. He knows that the sovereignty of God is beyond his own circumstances. It's so much bigger. It's so much bigger. And there it is. That's the key. That's the lesson. The big problem is this. More often than not, far more often than not, believers allow their circumstances to shape their understanding of God rather than allowing their understanding of God to shape what they believe about their circumstances. We get it backwards. Start wondering where God is and why God doesn't care and why he doesn't do the right thing and the thing is so obvious and where is he at and what's going on? And Nehemiah doesn't do that. Nehemiah allows his understanding of God to shape what he thinks about the circumstances around him. The difficult, hard, heartbreaking, scary, dangerous circumstances around him. Now that I've given you a synopsis of the entire story here, we're going to look at a little bit of the evidence. We're going to look at a little bit of the evidence. Some of you are saying, he hasn't even read us a verse hardly. We want the Bible. Some of you weren't. But some of you are saying, we want the Bible. Well, here you go. What do you do when you hear difficult, heartbreaking news? When Nehemiah hears from his brother Hananiah, who had just come back from Jerusalem to Persia, what was going on in Jerusalem, he weeps, he mourns, he fasts, and then you ready? He prays. Nehemiah 1:5 through 10 reads like this. Nehemiah 1:5 through 10. Then I said, Lord, God of heaven, great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commands. Let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly towards you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. Did you hear that prayer? Woo! Do you pray that way? Worship. God of heaven. Great God. Awesome God. The God who keeps his covenant, his word. Confession. Man, we are all sinners. I have sinned. My family has sinned. My forefathers have sinned. The nation has sinned. We have disobeyed you. You are just. I mean, you said you'd scatter us. We did it. You scattered us. But you also said you'd bring us back. Submit. Repent. I will obey. We will obey. Use me today. Make a way for me in this very moment. In this very moment. What do you do when you're confronted by powerful, intimidating people who think they hold your fate in their hands? Nehemiah chapter 2, 1 through 5 reads like this. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now, when I am confronted by intimidating people who hold my fate in their hands, I give them a really strong drink. That's the wrong application. It's the wrong application. Don't do that. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me. We have this thing in Italian called che face. Che face means what's wrong with your face. What is wrong with your face? Or if you really have a problem, it's called che face, brutto. Why is your face so ugly? Okay. Artaxerxes asks him, why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? I know you're not sick because you're living in the lap of luxury. What's your problem? This can be nothing but sadness of heart, Artaxerxes says. I was very much afraid. But I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Now remember, Nehemiah is a very high-ranking person in the king's court. In fact, he's in charge of a province in Persia, and he's thinking about from the king's perspective. He's bringing me news. I'm King Artaxerxes. He's bringing me news that some place in my world, in my empire, is in ruins, and there's a problem. Tell me about it, okay? This is a good thing. I want to know what's going on in my empire. The king said to me, what is it you want? Ooh. Think about that. What's the next sentence? Then I prayed to the God of heaven. And I answered the king. If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it. Although this is a short prayer, undoubtedly, that I prayed. You know, what would you be praying at that moment? Don't doubt its sincerity. I suspect, the Bible doesn't tell us what he prayed. I suspect it's something along the lines of, you know, oh Lord, speak through me. Oh Lord, give me the words. You know, something along those lines. Where truth exists, courage abounds. Where truth exists, courage abounds. Nehemiah knows. It is not the king who will grant him permission, ultimately. Nehemiah knows that God is in control, that God is in charge. And Nehemiah, I suspect, is praying for strength or boldness to stand before the king or the right words to make his heart known to the king. But Nehemiah knows that God is sovereign. It's God who's in control here because he stopped before he answered the king to pray to the God of heaven. What do you do? What do you do when you are ridiculed and insulted? Are you ever ridiculed, insulted? Have you ever been ridiculed and insulted? Mocked, teased, made fun of? Nehemiah 4, 4 through 5 reads like this. He prays. Hear us, our God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. It's like, you know, I'm made of rubber, you're made of glue, whatever you say bounces off me, sticks to you. You know, I mean, it's that kind of thing. Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt. Or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders. A little further on in Nehemiah 6:9, he says that God will remember those who are trying to intimidate him. In other words, here, He knows that they're not in control. God's in control. God is sovereign. We are not accountable to our accusers. We are not accountable to those who mock us, who demean us. We are not accountable to them. Our accusers, our mockers, and those who demean us are accountable to our God. And woe be to them. You are a child of God, a good, perfect, loving, compassionate, and all-powerful God. And woe be to those who ridicule us. We should not fear them. They should fear Him. What do you do when you are being intimidated, frightened, and falsely accused? Nehemiah 6:9 reads like this. They were all trying to frighten us, thinking, quote, their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed. Now strengthen my hands. He didn't pray, shut their mouths. He didn't pray, make them go away, make them stop it. He didn't even pray, Lord, calm my heart or uplift my spirits. He did pray, strengthen my hands so that I may do what you have called me to do. What do you do when your life is literally being threatened? My life has been threatened 3 or 4 times. Seriously, threatened. I didn't do this. I did not do this. Nehemiah 4:8-9. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. But we prayed to our God. And, this is the part I like, and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. Well, if we have to do the work with a shovel in one hand and a sword in another, we'll do it. It's an amazing thing. They prayed and they prepared. They prayed and they prepared. When Nehemiah is confronted with difficult, discouraging, heartbreaking news, or he's ridiculed and mocked, made fun of, intimidated, bullied, or he's lied against and false accusations are brought against him, or even when there were threats against his life or their life as a community, he knows that his circumstances do not shape his understanding of who God is. God shapes his understanding of his circumstances. He prays, and he prays, and he prays, and he prays. In fact, let's even be more specific. He prays first. Why are you here in my presence so sad? Pray! Okay, now I have to answer the king. I mean, that was a short off to God, you know? But he prayed first. I have to answer the king. I've got to give him an answer or off with my head possibly. But my fate is in God's hands, not the king's. So he goes to God first. I praise your name. I worship your name. You were right. We were wrong. We confess. We repent. We submit. Strengthen my hands. Strengthen my hands so I can do what you've called me to do. My fate is not in their hands. Their fate is in your hands. They're not my judge. You are their judge. And remember what they're doing here. find it intriguing that five times Nehemiah is confronted with external hardship. And his immediate first response is to pray. However, one time Nehemiah is confronted with internal strife, and prayer is the last thing he does. That's interesting. Why? Why? Why do we get this backwards? It's just as simple. When there are steps that are obvious, blatant, plain, in front of your face that will glorify God, when there are steps that are right here, that will enhance the reputation of God, which is your purpose, do it! Just do it! You don't have to wring your hands and you don't have to agonize. Should I do the right thing or should I do the wrong thing? Should we teach with grace and mercy or not? Should we give these loans out and take them in with grace and mercy or not? Should we treat each other with contempt and bitterness or love and compassion? I wonder what God wants me to do. Is the bitter thing or the grace thing? Can't figure this one out. I need to talk to the pastor. Why do we get this backwards? Why so often in our life when we are confronted with these really, really difficult things and these attacks and the hardships, is prayer the last thing we do? But when the road is plain and straight and right in front of us and it glorifies God, prayer's the first thing we do. Oh, Lord, tell me what to do. Doesn't make sense to me. But I do it. In that moment, he cajoles them. Do the godly thing. Why are you acting like the fools out there? You're a chosen people and a chosen task. Act like chosen people. Do the godly thing. And then he prays, bless the godly thing we've chosen to do today. At the end of it. My dear friends, whether internally or externally, whether it's from inside of us, our own expectations, our own desires, our own confusion maybe, whether it's from the world around us, the fallenness, the brokenness, the tragedy, the evil, whether it's from God's enemy and our enemy, evil cloaked in friendliness, common good, common sense, common, 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 or evil trying to intimidate and bully, lying, labeling, illegalizing. Every day of your life, something or someone will attempt to shake you up like a snow globe. Have you ever felt like a snow globe? Every day, something or someone will try to shake you up. Distract you from God's purpose. Distract you from your high calling. What you believe, first in your mind, what you believe in your mind, which will eventually subdue your heart. But what you believe will determine whether or not the shaking is successful. Let me say that again. What you believe will determine whether or not the shaking is successful. Do not allow your circumstances to shape the understanding of your God. Do allow God and his sovereignty over, in, and through all things to shape the understanding of your circumstances.